Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
She was beautiful and intelligent, a philosopher, a mathematician, and a teacher. One of her contemporaries said that many came from a great distance to hear her explain the principles of philosophy, adding that she did not feel abashed in going to an assembly of men, for all men, on account of her extraordinary dignity and virtue, admired her the more. Yet she was violently done to death by a mob. History knows her as Hypatia of Alexandria. Hi and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders. Hypatia was a Greek woman born between 350 AD and 370 in the city of Alexandria in Roman Egypt. She was a pagan, a Neoplatonist philosopher who emphasized reason and logic. And though she was respected by many Christians, it was a Christian mob that killed her in 415. Maths was in Hypatia's blood. Her father, Theon, who was her teacher, was himself renowned as a mathematician, and it seems that they collaborated together on a number of works. She no doubt needed him. Like many women in the ancient world who came to public intellectual prominence, she had to have a man in her life who would make sure that she got an education and encourage her engagement with the world outside the family. But what about her city? What was Alexandria like when she lived there? Michael Deakin, adjunct senior research associate in maths at Monash University, is the author of a book about Hypatia.
It seems to have been extremely faction-ridden and turbulent. There were Christians and a group called the Pagans, there were Jews, there were different Christian factions, and they were all at one another's throats, and the dissension became quite violent. People were being killed and tortured, and different groups tried to assert authority. The church authorities tried to interfere with the civil governance and vice versa.
But we're talking about a large, significant, cosmopolitan city.
Oh yes, very much.
Do we know a lot about her? I mean, you've talked about the degree to which it was a strife-ridden, factional city, and there are winners in the story, and the winners are the Christians. The Christians won out over the pagans. The winners are usually the ones who write the history. So are the sources that we have for the life of Hypatia, are they for that reason suspect?
Some clearly are. There's an account that was found in an Ethiopic manuscript in the 19th century, and that probably gives the official line where she's totally condemned. She's a witch who beguiles people with satanic wiles, all this sort of stuff, and her death is a triumph for the goodies. But other Christians are more balanced. The most complete account comes from a fellow called Socrates Scholasticus. He lived probably about 25 or 30 years after Hypatia, and he's quite critical of the bishop of the time, that's St. Cyril of Alexandria. So he's not just towing a party line the way the Ethiopic manuscript did.
You said that some of these sources refer to her as having sort of cunning, seductive wiles.
Yes.
Was she actually a physically attractive woman, or is this just part, paradoxically, part of the image that her enemies are trying to present of her?
No, there are several accounts of her being a physically beautiful woman, both from pagan and Christian sources. So I think we can take it that she was attractive.
What do we know about her role in Alexandrian society at the time? You say that she taught at home, but was she, as it were, a sort of intellectual around town?
She seems to have been, yes. She gave public lectures. presumably from her home. We don't know that completely. But she was also a well-known figure in the city, and she met frequently with the prefect or governor, a fellow called Orestes, who was supposed to be under her spell by her enemy, or her enemies supposed Orestes to have been under her spell. But all attest that there was a close relationship between the civil governor and Hypatia herself.
As well as being a mathematician, she was also a Neoplatonist philosopher, wasn't she?
I cast her as that. People have tried to reconstruct her philosophy, and I agree with an earlier scholar, Maria Gielska, that the best way to do this is to look at the extant writings of her best-known pupil, a fellow called Synesius of Cyrene. And he was clearly a Neoplatonist, and he sent her copies of some of his manuscripts with the intention of having her vet them. And as they're now extant, we know them in their entirety, she must have approved of them.
And what were her philosophical ideas, and do they connect with her work in maths?
I make a somewhat speculative suggestion, but I think it's a plausible one. If you look at the idea of Platonic ideals, they're a sort of hyper-reality that exists beyond what we see with our eyes and hear with our ears, etc. The best example of this is the use of our abstraction in forming mathematical concepts. For example, the one I give in the book is the example of the number 2, which is an abstraction from pairs of objects like hands and feet and couples and so on. Mathematicians in general, even when they don't personally agree with this as a philosophy, adopt in practice a Platonic idea and talk about the number 2 as if it were something perfectly real, and in fact much more elaborate things, the property of the circle, Pythagoras's theorem, these are all, so to speak, real for any practicing mathematician. So you're looking at a sort of hyper-reality in its most developed form when you're doing mathematics. I postulate that she thought of mathematics as a profoundly sacred pursuit because of this exemplification that it gave of the Platonic ideals.
Neoplatonists, of course, you're talking about the number 2 as an abstraction from pairs of things, but Neoplatonists were very keen on what they called the one.
Yes.
What was that, and why did it matter to them?
Well, if you think of the Platonic ideals and think of them as themselves reflecting a more fundamental ideal, that ideal there is the one. Of course, the way I've presented it, so to speak, looks at the wrong end of the telescope. That's our end of the telescope. We have to abstract to find Platonic ideals like the number one or any other mathematical concept, and then back from all these ideals to the ideal of ideals, which would be the one. But the one was responsible for the ideals, which in turn became instantiated in things like hands and feet and so on.
We come now to the somewhat fraught story of her death. What happened to her?
She was lynched and murdered by a bunch of Christian fanatics. They hacked her to pieces and burnt the pieces over what was probably a quite long period of time.
And oyster shells come into it, don't they?
It's not clear whether it was oyster shells or not. The Greek word can be translated as either oyster shells or roofing tiles. I tend to think it's more that she was battered to death with roofing tiles than sliced to death with sharp oyster shells, but Greek scholars just sort of toss their hands up and say, well, they're both possible interpretations.
Do we know why this happened? I mean, was this just a mob getting out of hand, or was there some sort of conspiracy here?
There was a lead-up to it. Orestes had been at odds with the bishop over a number of issues. The first one was that he had tried to prevent the bishop from expelling forcibly the Jews from the city, and obviously he got some of them back. He didn't want about a quarter of his population and a very significant portion to disappear from the city. The Christians, in one of their rampages, attempted an assassination of Orestes, and they must have come close to succeeding, but eventually Orestes was wounded, but he wasn't killed, and an alleged ringleader was tortured to death as a result of this. And one can imagine then that Orestes increased his guard fairly substantially, so that any Christians who wanted to get at him would have found that more difficult. So they took a softer target, or this is my interpretation, they took a softer target and took out Hypatia, who was close to him.
Michael Deakin, author of Hypatia of Alexandria, Mathematician and Martyr. On ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn, you're with an edition of the Philosopher's Zone dedicated to Hypatia, mathematician, martyr, and also philosopher. And for more on the philosophical doctrines to which she was dedicated, Neoplatonism, I turn to Christian Wildberg, professor of classics at Princeton University in the States. And the first thing I wanted to know was, did the people we now call the Neoplatonists call themselves Neoplatonists?
Absolutely not. The term is really a neologism that was introduced into the scholarly discussion in the 19th century. The Neoplatonists understood and called themselves as Platonists.
And what is there, given that the work of Plato is very complex and very wide-ranging, and you can get any one of a number of Platos from a reading of his work, what was their relationship to Plato's thought? Who was their Plato?
Well, that is a complex question, and I think there are answers on several different levels. So first of all, one could ask, how did they read the Platonic text? And it is certain that in their school, Plato's dialogues were objects of intense study. But I don't think that they read Plato in just the same way that we would be reading Plato, that is, trying to find out what Plato thought about this, that, and the other, how Plato's thought developed, and so on. What they were interested in was the truth. They were trying to discover what they could from Plato to get a handle on an understanding of reality. And what happened to Platonic texts in the Neoplatonists is that they used bits and pieces of Plato, passages, sometimes phrases, to get their own argument started. Now, the other issue is, why are these people called Platonists, and what is it that makes them Platonists? And I think the answer here is that they shared the common concern, the common project that Plato had, and, you know, what is it that makes somebody a Platonist? Because, as you said, you know, there are so many Platos in Plato, and there's such a rich tradition. And I think the common denominator really is a concern that is essentially an epistemological one. That is to say, Plato had deep worries about empirical knowledge, and he inherited this from pre-Socratic philosophy, from Parmenides. And the worry was that whenever you use your senses and try to understand something that is accessible to the senses, eventually you are going to lose grip on the object of your interest. And all you can ever have is some kind of deficient knowledge or opinion. But Plato thought there is such a thing as knowledge. There's got to be something that qualifies as knowledge. And if that knowledge is not about sensible things, it's got to be about something else. So he came up with the view that there must be objects of knowledge, and these are the forms, the ideas, which our intellect has access to, which our intellect can understand through pure thought and speculation. Now, this very radical thesis was a matter of contention for many centuries after Plato. But by the time of the Neoplatonists, by the 3rd century, by the time of Plotinus, all the other schools, the Stoics and the Epicureans, had dropped out of the picture, and this view was no longer challenged. And by the time of the Neoplatonists, the door was open to fully explore the intellectual realm and let in all kinds of views, structures, and speculations.
Well, you mentioned Plotinus. Who was he and what was his role in the history of what we now call Neoplatonism?
Plotinus is a very, very interesting figure. He was probably of Egyptian origin. He lived in the 3rd century and was obviously a brilliant teacher and philosopher. He really is the founder of Neoplatonism in our perspective of the history of philosophy. But within the school, within the academy, he was just one of the many voices of Platonists who were thinking along the lines of Platonic philosophy. And his immediate influence wasn't actually all that great.
One of the followers of the school of Plotinus was Hypatia of Alexandria, who it is said was brutally murdered by a Christian mob, and yes, whose death is said to mark the end of the Hellenistic age, the end, I suppose, of pagan philosophy. Does she emerge as an important figure here?
She does not, actually. I think the reason is that Hypatia was more of a mathematician than a philosopher in our sense of the word. There is a little known tradition in Greek intellectual thought, a tradition of mathematicians who pop up here and there, who were associated with the academy from the beginning, from Plato's academy onwards, people like Eudoxus. And Hypatia belongs to this tradition, really, of Platonism, which has more of a mathematical interest. And she does not really appear at all as an influence in the writings of those philosophers that we now classify as Neoplatonists. And I would take issue with the statement that the murder of Hypatia was somehow marked the end of pagan philosophy, because pagan philosophy flourished well into the 6th century under the age of Justinian.
This does, though, the possibility that she might have been murdered by a Christian mob does raise the question of the relationship between Neoplatonism and the increasingly successful Christian religion, with its emphasis on the one, and I'll have to ask you what the one is, but with its emphasis on the one, Neoplatonism might seem to lend itself to a view of the universe as being governed by a single deity.
Yes, again, a very complex question. In many ways, the relationship between Christianity and Neoplatonism was a very fruitful one, right from the beginning. People like Origen, for example, or Dionysius the Areopagite, people who were fundamentally engaged in exegeting Christian doctrine, were highly influenced by Neoplatonism. However, the Neoplatonists themselves were, of course, committed to their own tradition, which extended back 1,000 years of intellectual history, of unbroken intellectual history. The whole Olympian mythology belonged to it. They were trying to make sense of this in their own way and somehow had to incorporate all these myths in their philosophy. So it was a tense relationship, but it was not always a relationship of hostility. There was common culture.
In her days, it does look as though, it looks to me as though Neoplatonism did stand separately from the growing Christian movement. In fact, I gather that the patriarch Cyril began a campaign to rid the city of Alexandria of Jews and Neoplatonists, which suggests that they were seen as a danger.
Yes, the Neoplatonists were, I think it's fair to say, not just philosophers in the modern sense of the word. They were part of the political establishment in the town in which they were in. Very often they belonged to the upper classes, they belonged to the wealthy families, and they waged a certain amount of cultural influence, which stood in the way of the cultural program of the church. So, yes, there were tensions. But nonetheless, the bishops went into their classroom and learned philosophy from them, logic and natural philosophy and metaphysics.
And what is the one, what is the tension in Neoplatonist thought between the one and the many?
Now, we have to backpedal a little bit. Once you commit yourself to the view that there are objects of knowledge, then you have to concede that these objects have some kind of reality. They are unchanging, they are always what they are intelligible, and they are also causally involved in the world as we know it. And if you have that in place, then you might want to ask yourself, well, what are these principles? What are these ideas? What are these forms? How do they relate to one another? How many are there? What is the structure of the intelligible world? Now, you can only understand something on the basis of principles and causes. That's what understanding is. And you cannot have infinitely many principles and causes, because then you lose insight, you lose understanding. That is to say, the intelligible world itself has to be structured in some hierarchical way. And already Plato hinted that the highest principle is going to be some one thing. He called it the One. This was something you find in the Republic, but not terribly well spelled out. Plotinus is the one, under the influence of Aristotle's metaphysics in particular, who really tries to understand how it is that an intellectual principle, a unity, the principle of unity itself, can become productive in such a way that all the intelligible world, all souls, and all of nature can be understood to emanate, to come from it. This is an enormously complex, speculative enterprise, but this is what he was concerned about.
There are people much, much later who are today described as Neoplatonists in the 14th century, the 15th century in Italy, people like Massilio Ficino, Pico della Mirandola, Giordano Bruno, and in England in the 17th century there are the Cambridge Platonists. Are we talking about one of the longest-lived philosophical movements, or are we talking about separate outbreaks of thought at this much later date?
No, I think you're absolutely right. We're talking about one monumental movement that changes slightly over time, but receives its inspiration from the same sources and revives them, overlaid with their own concerns and points of view, but essentially it is the same project.
Christian Wildeberg, Professor of Classics at Princeton University, on the many centuries of the Neoplatonist project, Hypatia of Alexandria's project. The show is produced by Hypatia fan Kyla Slavin, with technical production by Pictish pagan Charlie McCune. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with another Philosopher's Zone.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.